her abdomen, but now she just worries about the colostomy bag. Matt's going to be repulsed by this, isn't he? The first time I saw a colostomy bag in medical school, I was surprised by how unobtrusive it was. There's even a line of fashionable bag covers adorned with flowers, butterflies, peace signs, hearts, jewels. A lingerie designer dubbed them Victoria's Other Secret. Have you asked him? I say. Yes, but he's afraid of hurting my feelings. I want to know. Do you think he'll find it repulsive? I don't think he'll find it repulsive, I say, realizing that I'm being careful with her feelings too. But he may have to get used to it. He's had to get used to a lot, she says. She tells me about a fight they had a few nights ago. Matt was watching a show, but Julie wanted to talk. Matt was uh-huhing her, pretending to listen, and Julie got upset. Look what I found on the internet. Maybe we can ask the doctors, she said. And Matt said, not tonight, I'll look tomorrow. And Julie said, but this is important, and we don't have a lot of time. And Matt looked at her with an anger she'd never seen in him before. Can't we have one night off from cancer? Matt yelled. It was the first time he had been anything but kind and supportive. And Julie, taken aback, snapped at him. I don't get a night off, she said. Do you know what I'd give for a night off from cancer? She fled to the bathroom and closed the door. And a minute later, Matt followed, apologizing for his outburst. I'm stressed, he said. This is very stressful for me. But not as stressful as what you're going through, so I'm sorry. I was insensitive. Show me the thing on the internet. But his words shook her. She knew that it wasn't just her quality of life that was changing. Matt's was too, and she hadn't been paying attention to that. I didn't tell him about the thing on the internet, Julie says. I felt so selfish. He should get a night off from cancer. This isn't what he signed up for when he married me either. I give her a look. Well, sure, the vows say in sickness and in health and for better or worse and all that. But that's kind of like clicking okay to the terms and conditions when you download an app or sign up for a credit card. You don't think any of that is going to apply to you. Or if you do, you don't expect it to happen right after your honeymoon, before you've even had a chance to be married. I'm glad that Julie is thinking about the impact of her cancer on Matt. It's something she's avoided talking about by changing the subject whenever I mention that maybe it was hard for Matt to go through this too. Julie would shake her head. Yeah, he's amazing, she'd say. He's so solid, so there for me. Anyway, if Julie had any awareness of the depth of Matt's pain, she hadn't been ready to face it. But something shifted with Matt's outburst, forcing her to acknowledge a difficult tension. Their togetherness on this unfortunate journey, but also their separateness. Julie is crying now. He kept wanting to take back what he'd said, but it was already out there, hanging between us. I understand why he wants a night off from cancer. She pauses. I'll bet he wishes that I would just die already. I'll bet sometimes he does, I think for a second. It's hard enough in a marriage to do the give and take of putting one's wants and needs aside for another. But here the scales are tipped, the imbalance unrelenting. Yet I also know it's much more complicated than that. I imagine that Matt feels trapped in time, newly married, young, wanting to live a normal life and start a family, all the while knowing that what he has left with Julie is temporary. He sees his future as a widower, then as a father in his 40s rather than his 30s. He probably hopes that this doesn't go on for another 5 years. 5 years at the prime of his life spent in hospitals, caretaking his young wife whose body is being cut apart. At the same time, I'll bet that he is touched to his core by this experience, that in some ways it makes him feel, as one man told me in the months before his wife of 30 years died, forever changed and paradoxically alive. I'd wager that, like that man, Matt wouldn't choose to go back in time and marry a different person. But Matt's at a life stage when everyone else is moving forward. The 30s are a decade of building the foundation of the future. He's out of sync with his peers, and in his own way, in his own grief, he probably feels completely alone. I don't think it would be helpful for Julie to know every detail, but I believe that their time together will be richer if there's space for Matt to show more of his humanity during this process, and if they can have a deeper experience of each other in the time that they have left together. Julie will live more fully within Matt after she's gone. What do you think Matt meant by wanting the night off from cancer? I ask. Julie sighs. All the doctor appointments, the lost pregnancies. Everything I want a night off from, too. He wants to talk about how his research is going, and the new taco place down the street, and, you know, the normal things people our age talk about. The whole time I've been going through this, all we cared about was finding a way for me to live. But now, he can't make plans with me for even a year from now, and he can't go meet someone else. The only way he can move forward is if I die. I hear what she's getting at. Underlying their ordeal is a fundamental truth. For all of the ways that Matt's life has changed, it will eventually return to some kind of normal. And that, I suspect, pisses Julie off. I ask if she's angry with Matt, envious. Yes, she whispers, as though she's sharing a shameful secret. I tell her it's okay. How could she not be envious of the fact that he gets to live? Julie nods. I feel guilty for putting him through this, and jealous that he gets a future, she says, adjusting a pillow behind her back. And then I feel guilty for being jealous. I think about how common it is, even in everyday situations, to be jealous of a spouse, and how taboo it is to talk about that. Aren't we supposed to be happy for their good fortune? Isn't that what love is about? In one couple I saw, the wife got her dream job on the same day that her husband was let go from his, which made for extreme awkwardness every night at the dinner table. How much should she share of her days without inadvertently making her husband feel bad? How could he manage his envy without raining on her parade? How noble can people reasonably be expected to be when their partners get something they desperately want but can't have? Matt came home from the gym yesterday, Julie says, and he said that he had a fantastic workout. And I said, that's great. But I felt so sad, because we used to go to the gym together. He'd always tell people that I was the one with the stronger body, the marathon runner. She's the superstar. I'm the wimp, he'd say. And the people we became friends with at the gym started calling us that. Anyway, we used to have sex a lot after the gym. So yesterday, when he gets back, he comes over and kisses me, and I start kissing him back, and we have sex. But I'm out of breath in a way I've never been before. I don't let on, though. So Matt gets up to shower, and as he's walking into the bathroom, I look at his muscles and think, I used to be the one with the stronger body. And then I realize that it's not just Matt who's watching me die. It's me, too. I'm watching myself die. And I'm so angry at everyone who gets to live. My parents will outlive me. My grandparents might, too. My sister's having a second baby. But me? She reaches for her water bottle. After Julie recovered from her initial cancer treatment, her doctors told her that drinking water flushes out toxins, so Julie began carrying a 64-ounce bottle everywhere she went. Now it's no longer useful, but it's become a habit. Or a prayer. It's hard to see what's still there, I say, and to let it in when you're grieving for your own life. We sit in silence for a while. Finally, she wipes her eyes, and the slip of a smile forms on her lips. I have an idea. I look at her expectantly. You'll tell me if it's too wacky? I nod. I was just thinking, she begins, that instead of spending my time being jealous of everyone else, maybe part of my purpose for the time I have left could be helping the people I love to move forward. She shifts on the couch, getting excited. Take Matt and me. We won't grow old together. We won't even grow middle-aged together. I've been wondering if, for Matt, my death will feel more like a breakup than the end of a marriage. Most of the women in the cancer group who talk about leaving their husbands behind are in their 60s and 70s, and the one in her 40s has been married for 15 years, and she and her husband have two kids. I want to be remembered as a wife and not an ex-girlfriend. I want to behave like a wife and not an ex-girlfriend. So I'm thinking, What would a wife do? Do you know what these wives say about leaving their husbands behind? I shake my head. They talk about making sure their husbands are going to be okay, she says. Even if I'm jealous of his future. I want Matt to be okay. Julie looks at me like she just said something I'm supposed to understand. But I don't. What would make you feel that he'll be okay? I ask. She shoots me a grin. As much as this makes me want to vomit, I want to help him find a new wife. You want to let him know it's okay to love again, I say. That doesn't sound wacky at all. Often, a dying spouse wants to give the surviving one this blessing, to say that it's okay to hold one person in your heart and fall in love with another, that our capacity for love is big enough for both. No, Julie says, shaking her head. I don't want to just give him my blessing. I want to actually find him a wife. I want that gift to be part of my legacy. As when Julie first suggested the Trader Joe's idea, I feel myself recoil. This seems masochistic, a form of torture in an already torturous situation. I think about how Julie would not want to see this, could not bear this. Matt's future new wife will have his babies. She'll go on long hikes and climb mountains with him. She'll cuddle up with him and laugh with him and have passionate sex with him the way Julie once did. There's altruism and love, sure, but Julie's also human. And so is Matt. What makes you think he'll want this gift? I ask. It's crazy, I know, Julie says. But there's a woman in my cancer group whose friend did that. She was dying, and her best friend's husband was dying. And she didn't want her husband or her best friend to be alone. And she knew how well they got along. They'd been good friends for decades. So her dying wish was that they would go on a date after the funeral. One date. So they did. And now they're engaged. Julie's crying again. Sorry, she says. Almost every woman I see apologizes for her feelings, especially her tears. I remember apologizing in Wendell's office, too. Perhaps men apologize preemptively by holding their tears back. I mean, not sorry, just sad, Julie says, echoing a phrase I shared with her earlier. You're going to miss Matt a lot, I say. I am, she squeaks out. Everything about him. The way he gets so excited about little things, like a latte or a line in a book. The way he kisses me, and the way his eyes take 10 minutes to open if he wakes up too early. How he warms my feet in bed and looks at me when we're talking, like his eyes are soaking up everything I'm saying as much as his ears are. Julie pauses to catch her breath. And you know what I'm going to miss most of all? His face. I'm going to miss looking at his beautiful face. It's my favorite face in the entire world. Julie is crying so hard that no sound comes out. I wish that Matt could have been here for this. Have you told him? I ask. All the time, Julie says. Every time he holds my hand, I say, I'm going to miss your hands. Or when he's whistling around the house, he's an amazing whistler. I'll tell him how much I'm going to miss that sound. And he always used to say, Jules, you're still here. You can hold my hands and hear me whistle. But now, Julie's voice cracks. Now he says, I'm going to miss you just as much. I think he's starting to accept the fact that I'm really dying this time. Julie wipes her upper lip. You want to hear something? She continues. I'm also going to miss myself. All those insecurities I'd spent my life wanting to change. I was just getting to a place where I really like myself. I like me. I'm going to miss Matt and my family and my friends, but I'm also going to miss me. She goes on to name all the things she wishes she'd appreciated more before she got sick. Her breasts, which she used to think weren't perky enough until she had to give them up. Her strong legs, which she often thought were too thick, even though they served her well in marathons. Her quiet way of listening, which she feared some might find boring. She's going to miss her distinctive laugh that a boy in fifth grade called a squawk, a comment that somehow stuck like a burr inside her for years, until that laugh made Matt glance her way in a crowded room and then make a beeline for her to introduce himself. I'm going to miss my freaking colon, she says, laughing now. I didn't appreciate it enough before. I'm going to miss sitting on a toilet and shitting. Who thinks they'll miss shitting? Then come the tears. Angry ones. Every day is another loss of something she took for granted, until it was gone. Like what happens to the couples I see who take each other for granted, and then miss each other when the marriage seems to be dying. Many women, too, have told me that they loathed getting their menstrual periods, but grieved the loss of them when they reached menopause. They missed bleeding, the way Julie will miss shitting. Then, in almost a whisper, Julie adds, I'm going to miss life. Fuck, 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 she says, starting soft and getting louder, surprising herself with her volume. She looks at me embarrassed. Sorry, I didn't mean. It's okay, I say. I agree. It fucking sucks. Julie laughs. And now I got my therapist to say fuck. I never used to swear like this. I don't want my obituary to read. She swore like a sailor. I wonder what she does want her obituary to say. But time is almost up, and I make a mental note to come back to this next time. Oh, who cares? That felt good. Let's do it again, Julie says. Will you do it with me? We've got a minute left, right? At first, I don't know what she's talking about. Do what? But she has that mischievous look again, and then it clicks. You want us to... Julie nods. The rule follower is asking me to yell obscenities with her. Recently, in my consultation group, Andrea had said that while we need to hold hope for our patients, we have to hope for the right thing. If I can no longer hold hope for Julie's longevity, Andrea said, I have to hold hope for something else. I can't help her in the way that she wants, I'd said. But sitting here now, I see that maybe I can, at least for today. Okay, I say. Ready? We both yell. Fuck, 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 fuck. When we're done, we catch our breath, exhilarated. Then I walk her to the door, where, as usual, she hugs me goodbye. In the hallway, other patients are leaving their sessions, doors opening at 10 to the hour like clockwork. My colleagues look at me questioningly as Julie leaves. Our voices must have carried into the corridor. I shrug, close my door, and start laughing. That was a first, I think. Then I feel the tears well up. Laughter to tears. Grief. I'm going to miss Julie, and I'm having a hard time with this myself. Sometimes, the only thing to do is yell, fuck.
Chapter 36. The Speed of Want. After completing my traineeship year, I began my internship at a nonprofit clinic located in the basement of a sleek office building. Upstairs, the light-filled suites had views of Los Angeles's mountains to one side and beaches to the other. But downstairs was another story. In cramped, cave-like, windowless consultation rooms, furnished with decades-old chairs, broken lamps, and torn sofas, we interns thrived on patient volume. When a new case came in, we all vied for it, because the more people we saw, the more we learned, and the closer we came to finishing our hours. Between back-to-back sessions, clinical supervision, and mounds of paperwork, we didn't pay much attention to the fact that we were living underground. Sitting in the break room, aroma, microwaved popcorn, and ant spray, we would scarf down some food, lunch was always eaten al desco, and commiserate about our lack of time. But despite our gripes, our initiation as therapists felt exhilarating, partly because of the steep learning curve and our wise supervisors, who gave us advice like, if you're talking that much, you can't be listening. And its variant, you have two ears and one mouth. There's a reason for that ratio. And partly because we knew this phase was blessedly temporary. The light at the end of the years-long tunnel was licensure, when we imagined we could improve people's lives by doing the work we loved, but with reasonable hours and a less frenetic pace. As we hunkered down in that basement, doing our charts by hand and searching for reception on our phones, we didn't realize that upstairs, a revolution was underway, one of speed, ease, and immediate gratification, and that what we were being trained to offer, gradual but lasting results that required some hard work, was becoming increasingly obsolete. I'd seen hints of these developments in my patients at the clinic, but focused on my own harried existence, I failed to see the bigger picture. I thought, of course these people have trouble slowing down or paying attention or being present. That's why they're in therapy. My life wasn't much different, of course, at least during this phase. The faster I finished my work, the sooner I'd get to spend time with my son. And then the quicker we could do the bedtime routine, the quicker I could get to bed so that I could wake up the next day and hurry all over again. And the quicker I moved, the less I saw, because everything became a blur. But this would end soon, I reminded myself. Once I finished my internship, my real life would begin. One day, I was in the break room with some fellow interns, and we once again started counting our required numbers of hours and calculating how old we'd be when we finally got licensed. The higher the number, the worse we felt. A supervisor in her 60s walked by and overheard the conversation. You'll turn 30 or 40 or 50 anyway, whether your hours are finished or not, she said. What does it matter what age you are when that happens? Either way, you won't get today back. We all went quiet. You won't get today back. What a chilling idea. We knew that our supervisor was trying to tell us something important, but we didn't have time to think about it. Speed is about time, but it's also closely related to endurance and effort. The faster the speed, the thinking goes, the less endurance or effort required. Patience, on the other hand, requires endurance and effort. It's defined as the bearing of provocation, annoyance, misfortune, or pain without complaint, loss of temper, irritation, or the like. Of course, much of life is made up of provocation, annoyance, misfortune, and pain. In psychology, patience might be thought of as the bearing of these difficulties for long enough to work through them. Feeling your sadness or anxiety can also give you essential information about yourself and your world. But while I was down in that basement rushing toward licensure, the American Psychological Association published a paper called Where Has All the Psychotherapy Gone? It noted that 30% fewer patients received psychological interventions in 2008 than they had 10 years earlier, and that since the 1990s, the managed care industry, the same system that my medical school professors had warned us about, had been increasingly limiting visits and reimbursements for talk therapy, but not for drug treatment. It went on to say that in 2005 alone, pharmaceutical companies spent $4.2 billion on direct-to-consumer advertising and $7.2 billion on promotion to physicians, nearly twice what they spent on research and development. Of course, it's a lot easier and quicker to swallow a pill than to do the heavy lifting of looking inside yourself. And I had nothing against patients using medication to feel better. Just the opposite. I was, in fact, a strong believer in the tremendous good it often did in the right situations. But did 26% of the general population in this country really need to be on psychiatric medications? After all, it wasn't that psychotherapy didn't work. It was that it didn't work fast enough for today's patients, who were now tellingly called consumers. There was an unspoken irony to all of this. People wanted a speedy solution to their problems. But what if their moods had been driven down in the first place by the hurried pace of their lives? They imagined that they were rushing now in order to savor their lives later. But so often, later never came. The psychoanalyst Erich Fromm had made this point more than 50 years earlier. Modern man thinks he loses something, time, when he does not do things quickly. Yet he does not know what to do with the time he gains except kill it. Fromm was right. People didn't use extra time earned to relax or connect with friends or family. Instead, they tried to cram more in. One day, as we interns begged to be given more new cases despite our full caseloads, our supervisor shook her head. The speed of light is outdated, she said dryly. Today, everybody moves at the speed of want. Indeed, I sped through. Before long, I completed my internship, passed my board exams, and moved upstairs into an airy office with a view of the world around me. After two false starts, Hollywood, medical school, I was ready to begin a career I felt passionate about, and my being older also gave it a sense of urgency. I had taken a circuitous route, arriving late to the game, and though now I could finally slow down and appreciate the hard-won fruits of my labor, I still felt as rushed as I had in my internship. This time, I felt rushed to enjoy it. I sent out an email announcement introducing my practice and did some networking. After 6 months, I had a smattering of patients. But then the numbers seemed to plateau. Everyone I spoke to was having a similar experience. I joined a consultation group for new therapists, and one night, after we'd discussed our cases, the conversation turned to the state of our practices. Were we imagining things, or was our generation of therapists doomed? Somebody said she had heard about branding specialists specifically for therapists, professionals who could help to bridge the gap between the culture's need for speed and ease and what we were trained to do. We all laughed. Branding consultants for therapists? How ludicrous! The influential therapists of the past that we admired would be turning in their graves. But secretly, she got my attention. A week later, I found myself on the phone with a branding consultant for therapists. Nobody wants to buy therapy anymore, the consultant said matter-of-factly. They want to buy a solution to a problem. She made some suggestions about positioning myself for this new marketplace, even proposing that I should offer text therapy. But the whole thing made me uncomfortable. Still, she was right. The week before Christmas, I got a call from a man in his early 30s about coming in for therapy. He explained that he wanted to figure out whether to marry his girlfriend, and he hoped we could resolve this quickly because Valentine's Day was coming up, and he knew he had to produce a ring or she'd bail. I explained that I could help him with clarity, but couldn't guarantee his timeline. It was a big life question, and I didn't know anything about him yet. We set up an appointment. But the day before he was to come in, he called and told me he'd found someone else to help sort things out. She'd given him a guarantee that they'd resolve the issue in 4 sessions, which would meet his Valentine's Day deadline. Another patient, who genuinely wanted to find a life partner, told me that she was going through people on the dating app so fast that several times she had contacted a guy only to have him reply that they'd already met. She'd actually spent an hour having coffee with this person, but she was cycling through her options so quickly that she couldn't keep track. Both of these patients were examples of, as my supervisor had put it, the speed of want. Want in the sense of a desire. But I also began to think of the term slightly differently, as referring to the other sort of want, a lack or deficit. If you'd asked me when I started as a therapist what most people came in for, I would have replied that they hope to feel less anxious or depressed, to have less problematic relationships. But no matter the circumstances, there seemed to be this common element of loneliness, a craving for, but a lack of a strong sense of human connection, a want. They rarely expressed it that way. But the more I learned about their lives, the more I could sense it. And I felt it in many ways myself. One day at my new practice, in the long lull between patients, I found a video online of MIT researcher Sherry Turkle talking about this loneliness. In the late 1990s, she said, she had gone to a nursing home and watched a robot comfort an elderly woman who had lost a child. The robot looked like a baby seal, with fur and large eyelashes, and it processed language well enough to respond appropriately. The woman was pouring her heart out to this robot, and it seemed to follow her eyes, to be listening to her. Turkle went on to say that while her colleagues considered this seal robot to be great progress, a way to make people's lives easier, she felt profoundly depressed. I gasped in recognition. Just the day before, I'd joked to a colleague, "Why not have a therapist in your iPhone?" I didn't know then that soon there would be therapists in smartphones. Apps through which you could connect with a therapist, anytime, anywhere, within seconds, to feel better now. I felt about these options the way Turkle felt about the woman with the robotic seal. Why are we essentially outsourcing the thing that defines us as people? Turkle asked in the video. Her question made me wonder. Was it that people couldn't tolerate being alone? Or that they couldn't tolerate being with other people? Across the country, at coffee with friends, in meetings at work, during lunch at school, in front of the cashier at Target, and at the family dinner table, people were texting and tweeting and shopping, sometimes pretending to make eye contact, and sometimes not even bothering. Even in my therapy office, people who were paying to be there would glance at their phones when they buzzed just to see who it was. These were often the same people who later admitted that they also glanced at pinging phones during sex or while sitting on the toilet. Upon learning this, I placed a bottle of Purell in my office. To avoid distraction, I'd suggest turning off their phones during sessions, which worked well, but I noticed that before patients even reached the door at the end of the session, they'd grab their phones and start scrolling through their messages. Wouldn't their time have been better spent allowing themselves just one more minute to reflect on what we had just talked about, or to mentally reset and transition back to the world outside? The second people felt alone, I noticed, usually in the space between things, leaving a therapy session, at a red light, standing in a checkout line, riding the elevator, they picked up devices and ran away from that feeling. In a state of perpetual distraction, they seem to be losing the ability to be with others and losing their ability to be with themselves. The therapy room seemed to be one of the only places left where two people sit in a room together for an uninterrupted 50 minutes. Despite its veil of professionalism, this weekly I-thou ritual is often one of the most human encounters that people experience. I was determined to establish a flourishing practice, but I wasn't willing to compromise this ritual in order to make that happen. It may have seemed quaint, if not downright inconvenient, but for those patients I did have, I knew there was a tremendous payoff. If we create the space and put in the time, we stumble upon stories that are worth waiting for, the ones that define our lives. And my own story? Well, I wasn't really allowing the time and the space for that. Gradually, I became too busy listening to the stories of others. But beneath the hectic bustle of therapy sessions and school drop-offs, of doctor appointments and romance, a long-repressed truth was percolating beneath the surface and just beginning to make itself felt when I arrived in Wendell's office. Half my life is over, I would say, seemingly out of nowhere, in our very first session. And Wendell would jump right on this. He was picking up where my internship supervisor had left off years earlier. You won't get today back. And the days were flying by. Chapter 37. Ultimate Concerns. I'm soaked when I get to Wendell's office this morning. During my short walk across the street from the parking lot to his building, the winter's first downpour began unannounced. Having no umbrella or coat, I threw my cotton blazer over my head and ran. Now my blazer is dripping, my hair is frizzing, my makeup is running, and my wet clothes are sticking to my body like leeches in the most unfortunate places. Too damp to sit. I'm standing by the waiting room chairs, wondering how I'm going to make myself presentable for work. When the door to Wendell's inner office opens, and out comes the pretty woman I've seen before. Again, she's wiping her tears. She lowers her head and rushes past the paper screen, and I hear the click-clack of her boots echoing down the building's corridor. Margot? No. It's coincidence enough that she's also seeing Wendell, but to have our weekly appointments back-to-back, I'm being paranoid. Then again, as the writer Philip K. Dick put it, strange how paranoia can link up with reality now and then. I stand there shivering like a wet puppy until Wendell's door opens again, this time to let me in. I drag myself to the sofa and settle into position B, arranging the familiar mismatched pillows behind my back in the way I've become accustomed. Wendell quietly closes the office door, walks across the room, lowers his tall body into a spot, and crosses his legs when he lands. We begin our opening ritual, our wordless hello. But today I'm getting his sofa wet. "Would you like a towel?" he asks. "You have towels?" Wendell smiles, walks over to his armoire, and tosses me a couple of hand towels. I dry my hair with one and sit down on the other. "Thanks," I say. "You're welcome," he says. "Why do you have towels here?" "People get wet," Wendell replies with a shrug, as if towels are an office staple. How strange, I think. And yet I feel so taken care of, like when he tossed me the tissues. I make a mental note to store towels in my office. We look at each other in silent greeting again. I don't know where to start. Lately, I've been anxious about pretty much everything. Even little things like making small commitments have left me paralyzed. I've become cautious, afraid of taking risks and making mistakes, because I've made so many already, and I fear I won't have time to clean up the mistakes anymore. The night before, as I tried to relax in bed with a novel, I came across a character who described his constant worry as a relentless need to escape a moment that never ends. Exactly, I thought. For the past few weeks, every second has been linked to the next by worry. I know the anxiety is front and center because of what Wendell said at the end of our last session. I'd had to cancel my next appointment to go to an event at my son's school. Then Wendell was away the following week. So I've been sitting with Wendell's words for 3 weeks now. Me. What fight? Him. Your fight with death. The skies opening up on me on my way in today felt appropriate. I take a deep breath and tell Wendell about my wandering uterus. Until today, I've never told this story from beginning to end. If before I'd been embarrassed by it, now, as I say it aloud, I realize how truly terrified I've been. Layered on top of the grief Wendell had mentioned early on, that half my life is over, has been the fear that I, like Julie, might be dying much sooner than expected. There's nothing scarier to a single mom than contemplating leaving her young child on this earth without her. What if the doctors are missing something that could be treated if found promptly? What if they find the cause but it can't be treated? Or what if this is all in my head? What if the person who can cure my physical symptoms is none other than the person I am sitting with right now, Wendell? "That's quite a story," Wendell says when I'm done, shaking his head and blowing out some air. "You think it's a story? Et tu, Brute?" "I do," Wendell says. "It's a story about something frightening that's been happening to you over the past couple of years. But it's also a story about something else." I anticipate what Wendell will say. "It's a story about avoidance." Everything I've told him since coming to therapy has been about avoidance, and we both know that avoidance is almost always about fear. Avoidance of seeing the clues that boyfriend and I had irreconcilable differences. Avoidance of writing the happiness book. Avoidance of talking about not writing the happiness book. Avoidance of thinking about my parents getting older. Avoidance of the fact that my son is growing up. Avoidance of my mysterious illness. I remember something I learned during my internship. Avoidance is a simple way of coping by not having to cope. "It's a story about avoidance, isn't it?" I say. "Well, in some ways, yes," Wendell replies. "Though I was going to say uncertainty. It's also a story about uncertainty." "Of course," I think. "Uncertainty." I've always thought about uncertainty in terms of my patients. Will John and Margot stay together? Will Charlotte stop drinking? But now, so much seems uncertain in my own life. Will I be healthy again? Will I find the right partner? Will my writing career go up in flames? What will the next half of my life, if I even have that long, look like? I'd once told Wendell that it was hard to walk around those prison bars when I didn't know where I was headed. I might be free, but which way should I go? I remember a patient who had pulled into her garage at the end of an ordinary workday and was greeted by an intruder with a gun. The intruder's accomplice, she would soon learn, was in the house with her children and their babysitter. After a horrific ordeal, They were saved when a neighbor called the police. My patient told me that the worst thing about this incident was that it had shattered her smug sense of safety, however illusory it might have been. And yet, whether she realized it or not, she still held on to that illusion. "Do you worry about pulling into your new garage?" I asked when the family, too traumatized to live at the scene of the crime, had moved into a new home. "Of course not," she said, as if it were an absurd question. "Like this would happen twice? What are the chances of that?" I tell Wendell the story and he nods. "How do you make sense of her response?" he asks. Wendell and I rarely talk about my work as a therapist, and now I feel self-conscious. Sometimes I wonder how Wendell would be with my patients, what he would say to Rita or John. Therapy is a completely different experience with a different therapist. No two are exactly the same. And because Wendell has been doing this much longer than I have, I feel like the student to his teacher, Luke Skywalker to his Yoda. I think we want the world to be rational, and it was her way of having control over how uncertain life is, I say. Once you know a truth, you can't unknow it. But at the same time, to protect herself from that knowledge, she convinces herself she could never be assaulted again. I pause. Did I pass the test? Wendell starts to open his mouth, but I know what he's about to say. This isn't a test. Well, I say, was that what you were thinking? How would you make sense of her certainty in the face of uncertainty? The way you did with her, he says. The same way I'd make sense of it with you. Wendell goes through the concerns I've brought to him. My breakup, my book, my health, my father's health, my son's rapid ascent through childhood. The seemingly offhand observations I'd pepper our conversations with, like, I heard on the radio that about half of today's Americans weren't alive in the 1970s. Everything I talk about is shaded with uncertainty. How much longer will I live? And what will happen in that time before I die? How much control will I have over any of it? But Wendell says, like my patient, I've come up with my own way to cope. If I screw up my life, I can engineer my own death rather than have it happen to me. It may not be what I want, but at least I'll choose it. Like cutting off my nose to spite my face. This is a way to say, take that, uncertainty. I try to wrap my mind around this paradox. Self-sabotage as a form of control. If I screw up my life, I can engineer my own death rather than have it happen to me. If I stay in a doomed relationship, if I mess up my career, if I hide in fear instead of facing what's wrong with my body, I can create a living death, but one where I call the shots. Irvin Yalom, the scholar and psychiatrist, often talked about therapy as an existential experience of self-understanding, which is why therapists tailor the treatment to the individual rather than to the problem. Two patients might have the same problem. Say they have trouble being vulnerable in relationships, but the approach I take with them will vary. The process is highly idiosyncratic because there's no cookie-cutter way to help people through what are at the deepest level existential fears, or what Yalom called ultimate concerns. The four ultimate concerns are death, isolation, freedom, and meaninglessness. Death, of course, is an instinctive fear that we often repress, but that tends to increase as we get older. What we fear isn't just dying in the literal sense, but in the sense of being extinguished, the loss of our very identities, of our younger and more vibrant selves. How do we defend against this fear? Sometimes we refuse to grow up. Sometimes we self-sabotage. And sometimes we flat out deny our impending deaths. But as Yalom wrote in Existential Psychotherapy, our awareness of death helps us live more fully and with less, not more, anxiety. Julie, with the wacky risks she's been taking, is a perfect example of this. I never paid attention to my own death until I embarked on the medical mystery tour. And even then, boyfriend allowed me to distract myself from my fears of extinction, both professional and actual. But he also offered me an antidote to my fear of isolation, another ultimate concern. There's a reason that solitary confinement makes prisoners literally go crazy. They experience hallucinations, panic attacks, obsessional behavior, paranoia, despair, difficulty with focus, and suicidal ideation. When released, these people often struggle with social atrophy, which renders them unable to interact with others. Perhaps this is simply a more intense version of what happens with our increasing want, our loneliness, created by our speedy lifestyles. And then there's the third ultimate concern, freedom, and all the existential difficulties that freedom poses for us. On the surface, it's almost laughable how much freedom I have. If, as Wendell pointed out, I'm willing to walk around those bars. But there's also the reality that as people get older, they face more limitations. It becomes harder to change careers or move to a different city or marry a different person. Their lives are more defined, and sometimes they crave the freedom of youth. But children, bound by parental rules, are really free only in one respect: emotionally. For a while, at least, they can cry or laugh or have tantrums unselfconsciously. They can have big dreams and unedited desires. Like many people my age, I don't feel free because I've lost touch with that emotional freedom. And that's what I'm doing here in therapy, trying to free myself emotionally again. In a way, this midlife crisis may be more about opening up than shutting down, an expansion rather than a constriction, a rebirth rather than a death. I remember when Wendell said that I wanted to be saved. But Wendell isn't here to save me or solve my problems, as much as to guide me through my life as it is, so that I can manage the certainty of uncertainty without sabotaging myself along the way. Uncertainty, I'm starting to realize, doesn't mean the loss of hope. It means there's possibility. I don't know what will happen next. How potentially exciting. I'm going to have to figure out how to make the most of the life I have, illness or not, partner or not, the march of time notwithstanding. Which is to say, I'm going to have to look more closely at the fourth ultimate concern: meaninglessness. Chapter 38. Legoland. "You know why I'm late?" John says, as soon as I open the door to the waiting room. It's 15 minutes past the hour, and I'd assumed he wasn't coming. A month went by before he responded to my message after his no-show. He'd unexpectedly resurfaced and asked to come in. But maybe, I thought before he arrived, he got cold feet. Indeed, on the walk down the hallway, John goes on to say that after he pulled into the building's parking lot, he sat in his car, debating whether to come upstairs. The attendant asked for his keys, but John said he needed a minute, so the attendant told him to pull over toward the exit. And by the time John decided to stay, the attendant informed him that the lot was full. John had to find a spot on the street and sprint the 2 blocks to my building. "Can a person have a minute to sit in his own car and collect his thoughts?" John asks. As we enter my office, I think about how beleaguered he tends to feel. Today he looks ragged, exhausted. So much for his sleep medication. John lowers himself onto the couch, kicks off his shoes, then stretches out, lies down, and adjusts his head on the pillows. Usually he sits cross-legged on the sofa, so this is a first. I notice, too, that there's no food today. "Okay, you win," he begins with a sigh. "Win what?" I ask. "The pleasure of my company," he deadpans. I raise my eyebrows. "The explanation to the mystery," he continues. "I'm going to tell you the story. So lucky you, you win." "I didn't know we were competing," I say. "But I'm glad you're here." "Oh, for Christ's sake," he says. "Let's not analyze everything, okay? Let's just do this, because if we don't start now, I'm 2 seconds away from leaving." He rolls over to face the back of the couch, and then, very quietly, says to the fabric, So, we were going on a family trip to Legoland.
According to John, he and Margot were driving down the California coast with the kids to Legoland, a theme park in Carlsbad, for a long weekend away when they had a disagreement. It had been their policy never to argue in front of the children, and up to that point, they'd both kept their promise. At the time, John was in charge of his first television show, which meant that he was on call day and night in order to get each week's episode out. Margot also felt overwhelmed, taking care of two young kids and trying to keep up with her graphic design clients. But while John got to interact with adults all day, Margot was either in mommy land, as she put it, or working at her home computer. Margot looked forward to seeing John at the end of the day. But at dinner, he would answer calls while she gave him what he termed the death stare. When things got so busy that John couldn't make it home for dinner, Margot would ask him to turn off his cell at bedtime so that they could catch up and relax together without interruption. But John insisted that he couldn't be unreachable. "I didn't work this hard all these years only to get this opportunity and see my show fail," he told her. And indeed, it was off to a rocky start. The ratings were disappointing, but critics raved about the show, so the network agreed to give it more time to find an audience. The reprieve was a short one, though. If the ratings didn't improve quickly, the show would be canceled. John doubled his efforts and made some changes, including firing some idiots. And the show took off. The network had a hit on its hands, and John had a very angry wife on his. With the show's success, John got even busier. "Did he remember that he had a wife?" Margot asked him. "What about his kids who, when Margot called out, 'Daddy's here,' ran to the computer instead of the front door because they were so used to talking to Daddy on a screen? The younger one had even begun calling the computer Daddy." "Yes," Margot conceded. "John spent time with them on weekends, playing with them in the park for hours, taking them on outings, and horsing around with them at home. But even then, the ringing phone never left his side." John didn't understand why Margot was making such a big deal out of this. When he became a father, he was surprised at how intense and immediate the bond was. His connection with his babies felt so powerful, fierce even. It reminded him of the love he'd had as a boy for his mother before she died. It was a kind of love he didn't even experience with Margot, though he loved her deeply, despite their disagreements. The first time he'd seen her, she was standing across the room at a party, laughing at something some doofus had said. Even from afar, John could see that it was the laugh of somebody being polite but thinking, "What an idiot." John was smitten. He walked over to Margot, made her laugh for real, and married her a year later. Still, the way he loved his wife was different from the way he loved his kids. If his love for his wife was romantic and warm, his love for his kids was like a volcano. When he read Where the Wild Things Are to them, and they asked why the wild things wanted to eat the kid, he knew exactly why. "Because of how much they love him," he said, pretending to swallow them as they giggled so hard they could barely breathe. He understood that devouring love. So what if he took calls when he was with his kids? He spent time with them, they adored him, and it was his professional success, after all, that provided them with the kind of financial security that he'd wished he'd had growing up as the son of two teachers. Yes, John was under a lot of pressure at work, but he loved creating characters and making up entire worlds as a writer, the very craft that his father had always aspired to. Whether by luck or talent or a combination, John had achieved both his and his father's dreams. And he couldn't be two places at once. "The cell phone," he told Margot, "was a gift." "A gift?" Margot had said. "Yes," replied John, "a gift. It allowed him to be at work and at home at the same time." Margot thought that was precisely the problem. "I don't want you to be at work and at home at the same time. We aren't your coworkers. We're your family." Margot didn't want to be mid-sentence or mid-kiss or mid-whatever with John, only to be interrupted by Dave or Jack or Tommy from the show. "I didn't invite them into our home at 9 p.m., she said. The night before the trip to Legoland, Margot asked John if he would please stay off the phone during their vacation. It was family time away, and it was just 3 days. "Unless someone's dying," Margot had pleaded, which John took to mean, unless there's an emergency. Please don't pick up the phone on this trip. To avoid another fight, John agreed. The kids couldn't wait to go to Legoland. They'd been talking about it for weeks. On the drive down, they wriggled in their seats, asking every few minutes, how much longer and are we almost there? The family had decided to take the scenic route along the beach instead of the freeway, and John and Margot distracted the kids by having them count the boats in the ocean and play a game in which they'd make up silly songs together, each person adding a lyric more hilarious than the last until they were all cracking up. John's phone was quiet. The night before, he'd warned the show's crew not to call. Unless someone's dying, he'd told them, quoting Margot. Find a way to handle it yourselves. They weren't complete idiots, he assured himself. The show was doing well. They could manage whatever came up. It was three fucking days. Now, making up silly songs in the car, John glanced over at Margot. She was laughing the way she'd laughed with him at the party where they'd met. He hadn't seen her laugh like that in, well, he couldn't remember how long. She placed her hand on his neck, and he melted into it, responding in a way he hadn't in, again, he couldn't remember how long. The kids were jabbering away in the back. He felt a sense of peace, and an image popped into his mind. He imagined that his mom was looking down from heaven, or wherever the hell she was, smiling at how well things had turned out for her youngest son, the one he'd always believed was her favorite. Here John was, with his wife and kids, now a successful television writer, heading to Legoland in a car full of laughter and love. He remembered sitting in the back seat himself as a young boy, squeezed in the middle between his two older brothers, his parents in the front, his dad driving, his mom riding shotgun and navigating, all of them making up song lyrics and laughing their heads off. He remembered trying to keep up with his older brothers when it was his turn to add a line, and how his mom delighted in his wordplay. So precocious, she'd exclaim each time. John didn't know what precocious meant. He assumed it was a fancy way of saying precious. And he knew that, to his mom, he was the most precious of the boys. Not the mistake, his brothers teasingly called him because he was so much younger than they were. But instead, as his mom said, a special surprise. He remembered seeing his mom put her hand on the back of his father's neck. And now Margot was doing this for him. He felt optimistic. He and Margot would find their way back to each other. Then, John's phone rang. The ringing phone was sitting on the console between him and Margot. John glanced at it. Margot gave him the death stare. John remembered his instructions to his staff to call only in case of emergency, unless someone's dying. He knew that today's shoot was on location. Had something gone wrong? Don't, Margot said. I just need to check who it is, John replied. God damn it, Margot hissed. The first time she'd sworn in front of the kids. Don't goddamn it me, John hissed back. We've been away only 2 hours, Margot said, her voice rising. And you promised you wouldn't do this. The kids went silent and so did the phone. The call had gone to voicemail. John sighed. He asked Margot to look at the caller ID and tell him who had called. But she shook her head and turned away. John reached for the phone with his right hand. Then they collided with a black SUV coming straight at them. Strapped in their booster seats were 5-year-old Gracie and 6-year-old Gabe. Irish twins, born just a year apart and inseparable. The loves of John's life. Gracie survived, along with John and Margot. Gabe, seated directly behind John, and at exactly the point of impact, died at the scene. Later, the police would try to piece together what had caused the tragedy. The two witnesses from nearby cars weren't much help. One said that the SUV veered across the lane, taking the curve too quickly. The other said that John's car didn't adjust to the position of the SUV coming around the curve. The police determined that the driver of the SUV had a blood alcohol level above the legal limit, and he was put in jail. Manslaughter. But John didn't feel absolved. He knew at the very moment the SUV had rounded the curve. He'd looked away for a millisecond. Or he possibly had,
though he thought his eyes had stayed on the road as he felt for the phone with his hand. Margot didn't see the SUV coming either. She was looking out the passenger window, toward the ocean, fuming at John while refusing to check his phone. Gracie couldn't remember a thing, and the only person who saw what was about to happen seemed to be Gabe. The last time John heard his son's voice, it was a piercing scream with one long word. Daddy. The phone call, by the way, was a wrong number. As I listen, I'm overwhelmed with heartbreak. Not just for John, but for his entire family. I'm holding back tears, but John, on the couch, has turned to face me now. And I see that his eyes are dry. He seems removed, distant, just as he had when he told me about his mother's death. Oh, John, I say, that's... Yeah, yeah, he interrupts, his tone a taunt. It's so sad, I know. It's so fucking sad. That's all everyone said when it happened. My mom dies. It's so sad. My kid dies. It's so sad. Obviously. But that doesn't change anything. They're still dead. Which is why I don't tell people. And why I didn't tell you. I don't need to hear how fucking sad it is. I don't need to see people's faces get that sad. Stupid look of pity. The only reason I'm telling you is that I had a dream the other night. You shrinks like dreams, right? And I haven't been able to get it out of my head, and I thought... John stops. Sits up. Margot heard me scream last night. I woke up screaming at 4 a.m, and I can't be doing shit like that. I want to say that what John sees in me isn't pity at all, that it's compassion and empathy and even a kind of love. But John doesn't let anyone touch or be touched by him, which leaves him alone in already isolating circumstances. Losing somebody you love is such a profoundly lonely experience, something only you endure in your own particular way. I think about how gutted and alone John must have felt as a 6-year-old when his mom died, and then again as a dad when his own 6-year-old died. But I don't say that right now. I can tell that John's feeling what therapists call flooded, meaning that his nervous system is in overdrive. And when people feel flooded, it's best to wait a beat. We do this with couples when one person is so overwhelmed by anger or hurt that all he can do is lash out or shut down. The person needs a few minutes for his nervous system to reset before he can take anything in. Tell me about the dream, I say. Miraculously, he doesn't balk. I notice that John isn't fighting me right now, and he hasn't once looked over at his phone today. He hasn't even taken it out of his pocket. He simply sits up, folds his legs under him, takes a breath, and begins. So Gabe is 16. I mean, he was in the dream. I nod. Okay, so he's 16 and he's taking his driving test. He's been waiting for this day and now it's here. We're standing outside by the car in the parking lot at the DMV, and Gabe looks so confident. He started to shave. And I see some stubble, and I notice how grown up he's become. John's voice breaks. What was that like? Seeing him so grown up. John smiles. I felt proud. So proud of who he was. But also, I don't know, sad. Like he was going to leave for college soon. Did I spend enough time with him? Had I been a good father? I was trying not to cry. In the dream, I mean. And I didn't know if these were tears of pride or regret or... Who the fuck knows, anyway? John looks away, like he's trying not to cry now. So we're talking about what he's going to do after the test. He says he's going out with some friends, and I'm telling him to make sure never to get in the car if he's been drinking or if his friends have. And he says, I know, Dad, I'm not an idiot. The way teenagers do, you know? And then I go on to tell him never to text and drive. John laughs, a dark laugh. How on the nose is this dream, Sherlock? I don't smile. I bring him back by waiting. Anyway, he continues. The examiner walks over, and Gabe and I give each other a thumbs up.
like the day I dropped him off at kindergarten right before he walked into his classroom. A quick, "You'll do great." But something about the examiner makes me nervous. "How so?" I ask. "I just have a bad feeling about her. Unsettling. I don't trust her. Like she's got it in for Gabe and he won't pass the test." Anyway, I watch them pull away. I see Gabe make his first right turn out of the driveway and it goes well. So I start to relax. But then Margot calls. She says that my mom keeps calling, and Margot wants to know if she should pick up the phone. In the dream, my mom is still alive. And I don't know why Margot's asking me this, why she doesn't just answer the goddamned phone. Why the hell wouldn't she pick up? So she says, "Remember, we agreed. Don't pick up the phone unless somebody's dying." And all of a sudden, I think that if Margot picks up the phone, it means my mom is dying. That she'll die. But if Margot doesn't pick up, nobody's dying. My mom's not dying. So I say, "You're right. Whatever you do, don't pick up the phone. Let it ring." So we hang up, and I'm still waiting for Gabe at the DMV. I look at my watch. Where are they? They said they'd be back in 20 minutes. 30 minutes go by, 40. Then the examiner returns, but Gabe isn't there. She walks toward me, and I know. "I'm sorry," she says. "There's been an accident. A man on his cell phone." And that's when I see that the examiner is my mom. She's the one telling me that Gabe is dead. And that's why she was calling Margot over and over. Because somebody was dying. It was Gabe. Some idiot on a cell phone killed him while he was taking his driving test. So I say, "Who is this man? Have you called the police? I'll murder him." And my mom just looks at me. And I realize that the man is me. I killed Gabe. John takes a breath, then continues his story. After Gabe died, he says, he and Margot bitterly blamed each other. In the emergency room, Margot growled at him. "A gift? You said the phone was a gift? Gabe was the gift, you fucking moron." Later, after the toxicology report indicated that the driver was drunk, Margot apologized to John. But he knew that deep down Margot still blamed him. He knew because deep down, John blamed her. Part of him felt that she was responsible. That if she hadn't been so stubborn and had just looked at the caller ID, John would have had his hand on the wheel and reacted more quickly to the swerving drunk driver, getting them out of harm's way. "The terrible thing," he says, "is that nobody will ever know who was responsible. The driver might have hit them anyway, or they might have avoided him if they hadn't been distracted by their argument." It's the not knowing that torments John. I think about how it's the not knowing that torments all of us. Not knowing why your boyfriend left. Not knowing what's wrong with your body. Not knowing if you could have saved your son. At a certain point, we all have to come to terms with the unknown and the unknowable. Sometimes we'll never know why. "Anyway," John says, returning to the dream. At that point, I wake up screaming. And you know what I say? I yell, "Daddy." Gabe's last word. And Margot hears this and freaks out. She runs into the bathroom and cries. "Did you?" I say. "What?" "Cry." John shakes his head. "Why not?" John sighs as if the answer's obvious. "Because Margot's in the bathroom having a breakdown. What am I gonna do? Have a breakdown too?" "I don't know. If I had that kind of dream and woke up screaming, I might be pretty shaken by it. I might feel all kinds of things. Rage, guilt, sadness, despair. And I might need to let some of it out. Open the pressure valve a bit. I don't know what I'd do. Maybe I'd do what you did, which is also a reasonable reaction to an intolerable situation. Numb out. Try to ignore what I felt. Hold it together. But I think at some point I'd just explode." John shakes his head. "Let me tell you something," he says, locking his eyes on mine. There's an intensity in his voice. "I'm a parent. I have two girls. I won't let them down. I will not be a basket case and ruin their childhoods. I will not leave them with two parents who are haunted by the ghost of their son. They deserve better than that. What happened isn't their fault. It's ours. And it's our responsibility to be there for them, to have our shit together for them. I think about his idea of having his shit together for his kids. How he feels that he failed Gabe and doesn't want to fail the others. How he feels that keeping the pain locked up will protect them. And I decide to tell him about my father's brother, Jack. Until he was 6 years old, the age that John was when his mother died, and the age Gabe was when he died. My father believed that he and his sister were their parents' only kids. Then one day, my father was rummaging around in the attic and came across a box of photos of a little boy, from birth all the way to about school age. "Who's that?" he asked his dad. The boy was my father's brother, Jack, who had died at age 5 from pneumonia. Jack had never been mentioned before. My father was born a few years after his death. His parents believed that not talking about Jack was a way of keeping their shit together for their kids. But their 6-year-old was shocked and confused. He wanted to talk about Jack. Why didn't they tell him? What happened to Jack's clothes, his toys? Were they in the attic with the photos? Why didn't they ever talk about Jack? If he, the little boy who would one day be my father, died, would they forget all about him too? "You're so focused on being a good dad," I say to John. "But maybe part of being a good dad is allowing yourself the full range of human emotions.